Today we're going to change topics and discuss anomalies, which are quantum effects that spoil classical symmetries. So one of the most important results we've studied so far this year is Noether's theorem. It says that for every symmetry of the action, there's an associated conserved current. So important, we've studied it in multiple different courses, from the classical mechanics course, QFT1, possibly others. And what I'm going to tell you today is that, in fact, Noether's theorem is a lie. Promised last time. So that is to say, Noether's theorem, while it's valid in classical physics, it is in general not true in quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanically, identifying a symmetry of the action tells us nothing about whether there is an associated conserved current in the quantum theory. And so to determine whether a would-be symmetry of the classical theory implies that there is a conserved current in the quantum theory, we need to determine whether or not there's an anomaly. So that's what we're going to discuss this week. So there are a number of different aspects of anomalies, and different types of symmetries can have different types of anomalies. We're going to focus primarily on the chiral anomaly because it's the simplest. And many of the techniques we'll study will generalize to other cases. And so what we're going to see is that anomalies, there are a number of different ways we can think about anomalies. So they have both UV aspects and IR aspects. So as we'll see in a number of different ways, one way to think about why anomalies occur is due to the impossibility of finding a UV regulator that respects all the symmetries. And we'll see in the example we studied today and again on Friday that most theories we study have multiple different symmetries. And while it's not too hard to choose a UV regulator that respects one or even most of the symmetries, what we'll see in a number of examples that it can be impossible to find a UV regulator that respects all the symmetries. And that tells us that in the quantum theory, it's impossible to for all of the symmetries to be valid and all of the associated conserved currents to actually be conserved. And so the fact that anomalies are related to the UV physics doesn't mean that they're not important experimentally and observationally. Anomalies have IR aspects. I'm not going to go into too much detail about how you can observe the effects of anomalies. Those of you taking the Standard Model course might see a little bit more of this. But they do have important effects in the IR, and so something you can measure is whether or not a current is conserved, or sometimes a symmetry can forbid a particular decay process. For example, in the Standard Model, there are light particles known as pions. There's a symmetry of the Standard Model that forbids the decay of the pion to two photons. Observationally, it's observed, and you can compute that decay rate very accurately using the ideas we'll discuss in this class. Okay. So where we're going over the next two lectures. So as I mentioned before, we're going to focus on one particular example, which is our chiral symmetries. And today we'll focus on simplest quantum field theory I know of that has an anomaly, which is massless quantum electrodynamics in D equals 2. And so we're going to make as many simplifications as possible to try to see in the simplest possible context how and why anomalies arise. And so you, after today's class, you may wonder how general what we're doing is, because we're going to make, again, as many simplifications as possible to really try to understand where it's coming from. There are a number of other perspectives we can look at that are more readily generalized to understand which other quantum theories have anomalies. And there are two main techniques that we can use more generally to determine whether a particular symmetry has an anomaly. And one is one way we can see whether or not the theory has an anomaly is by looking at the functional integral. And in particular, we say that a theory has a symmetry if the action is invariant under that symmetry transformation. But for the quantum theory to respect that symmetry, for the quantum theory not to be anomalous, we need more than that. So for computing a correlation function in the functional integral formalism, what we're computing is the integral with some measure over the fields of exponential of the action, possibly with some additional fields multiplying the exponential. But if the theory is a symmetry, we know the exponential part is invariant. That tells us nothing about whether or not the measure is invariant. And sometimes the measure will be invariant under the symmetry, in which case the symmetry implies that the current is conserved. And sometimes it won't be, and then there'll be an anomaly. And so this is one general way in which we can determine whether or not a theory is anomalous. The second way involves Feynman diagrams and perturbation theory. Those of you taking the standard model may see some more details about how that works. I may have time to say briefly a few words about that, but I'll focus on this functional integral way, which to me is the more transparent way to see where anomalies come from in the general case. Are there any questions about where we're going? Comments? Okay. So the simplest model to illustrate the general idea is massless two-dimensional QED. So in QFT1, we spent some time in the second part of the course studying the symmetries of the Dirac Lagrangian in four dimensions. And two of the symmetries that I want to remind you of are the U1 symmetry, where psi transforms to e to the I alpha psi, which has an associated conserved current, which you can either call J mu or just specify in the case where we're considering multiple different currents, jmu v, or v stands for vector. The current is a Lorentz vector. So this is one of the symmetries of the Dirac Lagrangian. If alpha is a constant, this derivative can pass right through. The exponential psi bar involves the dagger, so the Lagrangian is invariant. There is another symmetry where we put a gamma 5 in the exponential. This is also a symmetry. Psi bar will change the sign, but because the psi dagger will change the sign in the exponential, but so will commuting the gamma 5 past the gamma 0 that's hidden in the gamma bar. So gamma bar will transform with the same sign, and then you get another sign from commuting it past the gamma mu in a d slash. And the associated conserved current, sometimes called the axial current, or j mu 5, or 5 refers to the gamma 5, it's an axial vector. And it's the same as before, just with an extra gamma 5 thrown in here. And both of these currents are conserved classically. So d mu, j mu is 0, and so is d mu, j mu 5. These currents are conserved. So this is just a reminder of what we did in QFT1, four dimensions. We're interested in a slightly different theory. We're interested in d equals 2. Quantum electrodynamics. So we need to change two things. First, we need to couple this to a gauge field, which basically doesn't change anything. So QED, under both of these symmetries, so under the first symmetry, e to the I, A is unchanged. And under the second symmetry, E is also unchanged. AA is also unchanged. So QED has precisely the same, these two symmetries are precisely the same in QED as they are in just the free Dirac theory, and the currents are exactly the same. And basically nothing we did in QFT1 or nothing I've written on this board really depends on the dimension of space-time. Basically, the only difference, if we work in two dimensions instead of four dimensions, is that in 2D, our gamma matrices will be different. So gamma matrices should obey the anti-commutation relations that gamma mu with gamma nu is 2 eta mu nu. And I'll use the signature where eta mu nu in two dimensions is plus 1 minus 1. And in the chiral basis, we can choose gamma 0 to be sigma 1, which is just 0, 1, 1, 0. Gamma 1 to be I sigma 2, which is 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And gamma 5 to be sigma 3, which is minus gamma 0, gamma 1, plus 1, minus 1. So the gamma matrices change. Essentially, nothing else changes when we go to two dimensions. OK. And so the claim is that these currents, in particular, this axial vector current, is not conserved in the quantum theory. And so our strategy for showing that is first we're going to study the classical theory and try to gauge fix it just to make our calculations in the quantum theory as simple as possible. It's not necessary to gauge fix it. We will, on Friday, do things in a gauge invariant manner, but just for simplicity, we're first going to try to work in a particular gauge to simplify our calculations. And furthermore, we're not going to treat the entire problem quantum mechanically. We're going to treat the gauge field classically and the fermion fields quantum mechanically. That will be sufficient to show that the axial vector current or the chiral current is not conserved. If we treated both fields quantum mechanically, we'd get the same results. It would be an unnecessary complication, and we'll return to the more general case next time. But those are some of the simplifications we're going to work with. So, in a particular gauge, with a theory that's only partly quantum mechanical. Under these particular global symmetries, these are global. So here, alpha is a constant. So we're focusing here on the global symmetries, which have associated conserved currents via Noether's theorem. So yes, this theory has bigger symmetries, but if we're interested in finding the conserved currents, we just need to look at the global part. OK. So it'll be useful to, as we do in four dimensions, work in the Kalor basis, where psi can be broken up into positive and negative chirality parts. So just like in four dimensions, we can define projection operators, P plus and P minus, which act on psi so that P plus psi is an eigen state of gamma 5 with eigenvalue plus 1, and P minus psi is eigenvalue minus 1. And where here P plus and P minus are just like before, just like in four dimensions, 1 plus or minus gamma 5 over 2. So these are projection operators. We can project psi into positive and negative chirality parts. And our the fermion part of Lagrangian, psi d slash, or psi d slash psi, if we write it in terms of these positive and negative chirality parts, and I'll define b plus psi to be plus or minus psi to be psi plus or minus, we can write this fermion part of the Lagrangian as psi dagger plus I d0 plus d1 psi plus psi plus minus psi dagger minus I d0 minus d1. Psi minus. Where I've just written psi is equal to psi plus psi minus. We plug this in here, expand things out, write the fermion part of the Lagrangian like this. And we should note is that there are no mixing terms between the positive and negative chirality parts, which tells us, you can see this in a number of other ways as well, that we can define number currents for the positive and negative chirality parts. So you can write down a conservation equation, psi d mu psi plus or minus gamma mu psi plus or minus is equal to zero. So if I choose plus, that would be the number current for the positive chirality part. This is current that associated conserved charge would be basically the number of positive chirality particles, similarly for which is minus. So this equation tells us that the number currents are conserved, which another way to think about why the number current should be conserved is basically this equation is just linear combinations of these two equations. So if these two currents are conserved, so should any linear combination.
So why in the second term we have this 0 minus d1?
Mm-hmm. That just
the gamma matrices.
It comes from the gamma matrices. So d slash is d mu gamma mu. So there's some minus signs in the gammas.
Can you repeat what you said about the number currents?
So I can call this, say, j mu plus or minus. So this equation is telling us that j plus and minus are conserved currents. And I'm calling these currents number currents for the positive or negative chirality particles. And j plus and minus are just linear combinations of j mu and j5. And this equation, at least if it were valid quantum mechanically, would tell us that the number of positive chirality particles is conserved, and similarly for the number of negative chirality particles. That's what we'd expect based on the classical theory. And what we're going to show is that, in fact, this equation is not true in the quantum theory. So this is true classically. Everything I've written so far is true classically. Okay. So if we look at this equation, and, well, you can look at it in the limit where the gauge field is 0. So when the gauge field is 0, the Lagrangian simplifies, and we can write down the equation of motion. And the equation of motion in that case becomes I d0 plus or minus d1, psi plus or minus equals 0. So if a is 0, big D just becomes small d. And the equation of motion for psi plus will just be this with the plus, similarly for the minus. And so we see here that the solutions to this equation are waves that are moving either to the left or the right with speed 1 at the speed of light. And okay, so what we're going to do in a minute is we're going to still treat A classically, but we're going to treat the fermion field quantum mechanically. And our strategy is basically we're going to start with a zero gauge field and slowly turn it on. So we're going to see what happens if we basically perturb the quantum theory with zero gauge field to some quantum theory with a non-zero gauge field. And if we want to do that, we need to make sure that we can use perturbation theory to study the quantum theory. And in two-dimensional Minkowski space or two-dimensional Euclidean space, that would be problematic because in two dimensions, two space-time dimensions, if we have a point charge, the electric field from that point charge will be constant. The electric field doesn't obey, doesn't decrease with distance like it does in higher dimensions. So we do the two-dimensional version of Coulomb's law. So that tells us that the Coulomb potential will grow linearly if the electric field is constant from a point charge. And so that tells us that in if we have an infinite space for sufficiently large separations, eventually the Coulomb potential is going to become very large, and we can't use perturbation theory. We'd like to use perturbation theory, so we should resolve that problem. And one way to do that is just to compactify our space, so that there's some maximum possible separation between point charges, and then we can always treat things perturbatively. So we're going to compactify space. On a circle of radius L with E naught times L much less than 1 so that we can use perturbation theory. So in this case, we can Fourier expand our gauge field, and the Fourier expansion will be discrete. So I can write it as the sum of some A mu of t times cosine of 2 pi n over Lx.
What's E naught again?
E naught is the electric charge. So it's our coupling strength at some scale. So if this is particularly at a very low energy scale. So if our coupling is weak at some energy scale and there's some maximum distance, it can go away. It can't change very much, and it'll always be weak. So this is the requirement we'll need to have a perturbative theory.
Why do we want to compactify space? I don't quite.
It's because otherwise, we could never work in the weak coupling limit, because the electric, if we have a point charge in one spatial dimension, it will have an electric field that's constant. So regardless of how far away you get from that point charge, you'll experience the same electric field, which tells us that the potential should grow with distance. And so if we deal with large separations, that potential can become arbitrarily large, and will it be a perturbation from a case where we don't have an electric field or don't have a point charge.
I have like an idea of what it means to compactify, but I am not completely like sure of the concept.
So the idea here is that we are basically, we look at our diagram of space-time. So let's say time is on our vertical axis and space is on our horizontal axis. So if we were dealing with two-dimensional Minkowski space, this entire plane would be our space-time. What we're doing here is we're saying that this line here where x equals 0 is the same as the line where x equals L. So if we have some path that goes from x equals 0 to x equals L, this observer who's moving at a constant velocity would eventually return to the same place as an observer who moved at zero velocity. So these two observers would meet, even though this observer had basically traveled around the extra dimension. So one observer has gone around, the other one is stationary. They can meet up even if they have some relative velocity without any acceleration. We're imposing periodic boundary conditions on space only.
So the idea is that if we're working with boundary conditions, then we are going to define the potential only in that space.
That's right. So there's the maximum distance that any two particles can be away from each other is L over 2. That's as far away from each other as any two particles can be. So the general form of the gauge field in the space-time we're considering is this. We want to do some gauge transformations, try to fix the gauge to make A take a simpler form. So under gauge transformation, A goes to A mu plus D mu alpha. Alpha is some gauge transformation parameter. If we choose alpha to be minus the sum of L over 2 pi n times A1 of t sine of 2 pi n over L x, at least for n not equal to 0, we can eliminate the spatial dependence of A1, the spatial component of A mu. So we can, with this gauge, choice of the gauge parameter, we can set A1, which is in general a function of space and time, to be just a function of time. Okay, so these gauge parameters are periodic with period L. Now physically we know that our gauge field should be periodic, so if we go around space-time, go from 0 to L, we're coming back to the same point, so it shouldn't matter. Our gauge fields should be the same, regardless of whether we ask about the point x or x plus L. But alpha is just a parameter that defines our gauge transformation, so there's no reason that alpha should be periodic. We should choose alpha so that if we start with some A of this form, we remain after a gauge transformation with an A of this form that respects the periodicity. But there are choices of A that of alpha that are not periodic that do respect the periodicity of A. So in particular, we could choose alpha to be 2 pi n over L x. This respects, we take the derivative of this, it respects the periodicity of A, but alpha is itself not periodic. And this alpha takes A1 of t to A1 of t plus 2 pi n over L. So this tells us that A and A plus 2 pi n over L are gauge equivalent. And that means that essentially A1 lives on a circle as well. So this is telling us we should periodically identify A1 with A1 plus 2 pi over L.
That to me seems like a condition that I'm imposing that A1 of t should be physical. I mean that imposition, because after a gauge transformation, the original field and the resulting field do not have to be equal unless I demand that the field is physical, and that should be independent of gauge transformation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. What I'm saying is not that they have the same mathematical form. We could write down two different expressions, but I'm saying if I have two different A1s of t that differ by 2 pi n over L, those are the same physical configurations. So the physical, yeah, you're absolutely right that I should be more precise here. The physically distinct A1 live on a circle. And so it can be shown that basically we've used up essentially all of our gauge freedom if we choose to set A1 of t to be A1 to be only a function of time and to be somewhere in between 0 and 2 pi over L. The reason we can't do a gauge transformation to get rid of A1 of t of L is because the integral of A1 over, if we do an integral around the compact dimension, that's a gauge invariant quantity. So that tells us that there's no further gauge transformations we can do to get rid of A1 of t. So.
But this, sorry. We're going to restrict the A1 to go from 0 to 2 pi?
No? For any, if we're interested in some general, if we have a mu of x and t, we can do a gauge transformation so that we set A1 of t to be A1 to be only a function of t and not of x, to be a spatial constant living on the circle. So if we're interested in the, if we're interested in the physical configurations, are specified by the gauge field configurations where A1 is a spatial constant living on a circle.
What isn't clear to me is that it seems that A1 of t could be, oh no, got it, sorry, yeah.
Okay, so we've gauge fixed A, and now let's consider the fermion field quantum mechanically. So we are going to be working the limit where A1 is classical, slowly varying, so at in the adiabatic limit. And we're going to make the further assumption that A0 is 0. So we don't have any gauge freedom left to set this to be 0. But this A0, it can be shown this is a subleading effect. I'm not going to show that. But we will, as I alluded to before, on Friday drop many of these very restrictive assumptions, and we'll see if we get this essentially the same results. So I'm just going to make this further. This is an additional assumption. And so what we want to do is study the fermion field quantum mechanically. And so that means we need to look at the equation I d slash psi equals 0, the approximations we've made so far. We can write this as d0 plus I gamma 5 d1 minus I a1 psi equals 0. So just taking this equation and multiplied by gamma 0 and set a1 a0 to 0. The solution to this equation should be the stationary state solution should look like minus I E N T psi n of x, where psi n of x obey our periodic boundary conditions. So they're like e to the 2 pi I n x proportional. I'm not going to worry about constants of proportionality. So this is what we'd expect our stationary state solutions to look like. Should be periodic, and the energy eigenstate should evolve in time, like e to the minus I E n t. And if we plug this ansatz into this equation, what we find is that the energy states for the positive and negative chirality parts basically just differ by a sign. And the allowed energy level spectrum depends on the gauge field. We're treating as classical and slowly varying. And the energy levels are just separated by 2 pi n, 2 pi over L. They're equally spaced. So if we look at, I'm going to draw a diagram of the spectrum, which looks something like this. So we've got right movers, or positive chirality states. So they obey E equals P if they're moving to the right. And our states are just equally spaced. So here I'm drawing the spectrum of states. So it's a spectrum with A1 equals 0. And if we want to look at the ground state, so in the Dirac C picture, all of the states with zero energy or less are filled, and all of the in the ground state, and all of the states with positive energy are empty. So the ground state with A1 equals 0 has these states filled, and these states are empty. In the Dirac C picture. And the sketch for the left movers is very similar. They're moving to the left, so E is equal to minus P. Again, there's a state with zero energy. Is filled, as are all of the negative energy states. Positive energy states are empty. So that's what the ground state looks like in the Dirac C picture for A1 equals 0. And so what we're interested in seeing is whether or not the charge is conserved, or the currents are conserved. The question we're going to ask is, what happens to the charges if we slowly change our external gauge field? So let's define what the charges of our particles are. Let's say that the electric charge, or the charge associated with the vector current for our particles, is plus 1, or a left, or a plus or minus, I'll say left or right moving particle, and Q, the electric charge is minus 1 for a left or right antiparticle. So this is the charge associated with the vector current, associated with the symmetry that psi goes to e to the I alpha psi. We also have charges associated with the chiral or axial symmetry, the axial vector current symmetry, which I'll call Q5. And so Q5 I can define to be plus 1 for a right particle or left antiparticle, and Q5 is minus 1 in the other case. So for left particle or right antiparticle. And so the question we're going to ask is, what happens to these charges if we adiabatically change A1? So if the currents are conserved, the charges should be conserved, and we should have the same. There should be no change in either the electric charge or the axial charge if we change A1. Let's do that and see what happens. So if we change A1 from 0 to A1 equals 2 pi over L. What happens to the right moving energy levels is, so we have a minus sign here. So all of the energy levels are mapped to the next lowest energy level. And the opposite happens for the left moving particles. They're mapped up to the next higher energy level. And if the change is adiabatic, if we change this slowly, the occupation numbers should be unchanged. So this becomes the zero energy state, or the right movers becomes empty after this change. And the first positive, the lowest state with positive energy for the left movers becomes filled after we do this adiabatic change. And so that means, well, let's look at what happens to our charges. So the electric charge is unchanged because we have the same number of filled states before and after. And so the total electric charge is unchanged. But what happens to the charge Q5? So Q5, what happens in the right moving sector is that we've changed a filled state to an empty state. So we no longer have a right moving particle here. And in the left moving state, we have an additional left moving particle. So we've got an additional left moving particle and an additional right moving antiparticle compared to before. So the change in Q5 is minus 2 under this change. So this charge is not conserved, which tells us that this symmetry is not a symmetry of the quantum theory. And let's see what this tells us about what the correct version of the would-be conservation equation is.
How you found that the change is minus 2 again? So you said that.
So
antiparticle.
So compared to what happened before, so now in the left moving state, before we had all of these states filled, that part didn't change. What changed is that this first state changed from an empty state to a filled state. So that means we now have a left moving particle, which has Q5 equals minus 1. And in the right moving sector, what changed is, well, these empty states are still empty. These filled states are still filled. This state with zero energy went from being filled to being empty. So instead of having a particle, we now don't. So we lost a, or now we've got a, yeah, one less right moving particle. So the change in Q5 is minus 1 in that sector as well. So both sectors change Q5 by minus 1. So we can use this result to figure out what the quantum version of the conservation equation should be, or at least do an inspired guess about what it should look like, and we'll check that more carefully on Friday. So if we divide this by delta t, we get Q5 delta t is be minus L over pi delta A1 delta T. This minus 2 comes from the fact that we changed A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L. We changed it to 4 pi over L. We get a change of minus 4. So that tells us that, what the coefficient proportionality should be. The change in this argument shows that the change in Q5 should be proportional to the change in A1. and constant proportionality is fixed by this result. In the infinitesimal limit, this becomes Q5 dot minus L over pi A1 dot. And so using the definition that Q5 is the integral of J5 0, as well as the observation that you can write L times A1 as the integral of epsilon 0 mu A mu dx, because A1 is a spatial constant. So integrating over our compact spatial dimension just gives us an L. Epsilon 0, 0, 0. So we can write it like this. If we plug this into the right-hand side of this equation, this into the left-hand side of the equation, what we see is that, well, we have one component of this equation, d mu j5. We have the time derivative part only. Remember we've set a 0 to 0, so we're missing some information based on the approximations we've made. But it's consistent with, it's one component of this equation, that d mu j5, j mu 5 is equal to 1 over pi epsilon mu nu f mu nu. And so classically, we would expect the divergence of the current to be 0. Our arguments so far have suggest that this should be a pi, suggests that the correct equation should look something like this. So we wanted to make our results so far Lorentz invariant. So far, we've just basically set mu to 0 on both sides of the equation. If we want a Lorentz invariant result, it should look something like this, and we'll derive this more carefully on Friday. But this is the what's known as the anomalous non-conservation equation. And it says that our axial current is not conserved in the presence of a non-trivial gauge field. Are there any questions on that result? Yes.
I'm not sure how exactly, what is quantum mechanical about this treatment? Where exactly are we taking that into account?
So we computed the quantized energy levels of the fermion. And yeah, so there are many things to be skeptical about this derivation. It's really motivation for what's happening. And we'll go through things carefully on Friday to understand that we can understand all of this from the non-invariance of the measure. One nice thing about this picture is that we see, we can kind of see where the regulator dependence comes in. Because I made a number of statements that could be questions when I talked about what happened when we changed our gauge field from 0 to 2 pi. I claimed that the electric charge was not changed. That statement implies that there's nothing funny going on at large energies. So I assumed if I'm going to make a statement about there being no change in the electric charge, I need to put a regulator on here. Otherwise, I'm comparing infinity and infinity. I need to put a regulator to have a well-defined way of doing that. So this statement that there was no change in the electric charge under this change in the gauge field basically assumes that I'm have some regulator that's basically cutting off both right and left moving sectors of our theory in the same way. It's a natural way to do things, but basically, whenever a state moves below our cutoff, in one sector, another state moves above the cutoff in the other sector. So really, there was an implicit UV regularization in this derivation. And that's it's easy to see how that occurs in this case. And it's really a general feature of anomalies, is that we can think of anomalies as coming from the impossibility of finding a regulator that respects all of our symmetries simultaneously. Any other questions? All right. On Friday, we'll come back to this from the functional integral perspective.